This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Mary D. Williams experienced the power of gospel music at an early age. She grew up in Garner, North Carolina, and would often visit her grandparents on their farm nearby in Johnston County. She remembers listening to her grandmother sing African-American spirituals. As Mary got older, she learned a lot more about the history of that music and the role spirituals play in the American South. And along the way, she also began to sing. And for decades, she's traveled the world singing traditional gospel music. Today, Mary also helps teach a class called The South in Black and White. It's for college and university students across the Triangle. And Mary D. Williams joins us now in our studio. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank. Thank you for having me.
It's good to be able to spend the hour with you and talk about how you got into this music. Tell us about your first memories listening to gospel music.
Oh, my first memories were as a little child listening to records that my parents played, the albums, and listening to Mahalia Jackson, the Jackson Southerners, quartet groups, the Mighty Clouds of Joy. My father was a quartet singer, so that are pretty much, those are my fondest memories, because that's the music I grew up in. Sam Cooke with the Soul Stirrers. That's the kind of music that was always played in our home.
Yeah, and therein, and we'll talk more about this, about how gospel changed over the years. And Sam Cooke is probably a pretty good example of somebody who crossed over, yes, started singing the devil's music. So we'll talk more about that. But I want to hear more about your roots, too, because then you'd visit your grandparents in Johnston County, right? And listen to your grandmother sing. Tell us more about that.
That experience is really a part that is embedded in me. And it touches me in so many ways that I actually talk about all the time, but actually recently went back and did a concert in the Smithfield Public Library, which is actually where my grandmother had an experience in the Hudson Belt that was actually in that same building back in the 70s. And when we would ride into town, when I visit my grandparents, that big billboard that said, "Welcome to KKK Country." And at that time, there were no seatbelt laws, so I could sit in between my grandmother, Beatrice Dobbin, and my granddaddy driving, Jesse Dobbin, and ride into town with them. And I can remember walking in with my grandmother. She was a plus-size woman, but just a woman of great dignity. And my grandfather walking in with us. And
you're talking about walking into Belk Department Store?
Yeah, Belk Department Store. And she would just be holding my hand, but intentionally holding me kind of close. And I can remember some of the experiences, you know, that she had. And it was almost like her trying to prove to me that she could, but then what she would, you know, the fact that she was able to go there and to shop, but then the fact that how she was treated. I can remember distinctively one incident when they knew her by name, and the lady would say, "All right, B, you know, you touch it, you got to buy it, or you can't, you know, don't try nothing on, or you can't, don't try those shoes on," you know, things like that. And I can just remember, sometimes my grandmother, she would hold me close, but I can remember this, she would just kind of break off in this moan, you know, holding me. I'm like a kid. I'm thinking, what is this all about? You know, I'm like, what is all this? And I remember, you know, one thing I remember her saying to me, that when you moan, the devil don't know what you're talking about. I remember that specifically. But she would, that was that barrier, that way that that moan would come up out of her, or even when she would just kind of, in talking to me on the way back about how to conduct myself, you know, who I am, that I am a Dobbin, and how you are somebody, and how important it is to work hard and to have your own, and songs that she would sing even after we'd get back to the house, you know, "I don't feel no ways to, I've come too far from where I started from."
Nobody told me that this road would be easy. I don't believe he brought me this far to leave me.
So she would sing songs orally that as she worked, but it was always kind of telling me a story, always kind of strengthening me to know that no matter what you come up against, you hold fast. First of all, you hold fast to God, to the Lord. You hold fast to his word. And then you hold fast to the belief in who you are and the character. You hold fast to your character. You keep your name solid where you're able to sustain and hold your head up high with dignity. So she went through a lot in the town because my grandfather was not a sharecropper. They did not, in his words, did not believe in that. And so as a little girl, I think she spent a lot of time pouring that into me at those times when I was helping her do things or just kind of just spending that time up under
her. So these are people who are independent of the structures that had been designed or evolved to keep African-Americans under control,
yes.
Sharecropping and, you know, sort of the shopping rules. So apparently yes. Everybody knew that B was likely to try on a hat or something.
Yes.
That's why they gave her those warnings.
Yes.
Which, of course, would have attracted a lot of attention.
Yes.
And negative attention. I'm wondering about you as a little girl. First of all, taking on board the direct lesson, you know, be proud, hang on to your name, know who you are. But also the subtle lessons. I mean, as I hear your grandmother saying, you know, when you moan, the devil don't know what you're talking about. There's a couple of devils there, right? There's
yes.
there's the impulse for her to strike out. And there's also the devil that made that rule.
Yes, yes.
So it's a double, triple, quintuple code. But you're a little girl. How much of that, how much of what she was going through were you aware of?
I really, at some points, I wasn't aware of who the devil was at the time. I did realize later on that the devil was the storekeeper. At the time, in that moment. I also knew the devil in that moment was sometime represented as that part of my grandmother that wanted to lash out or just tell her off, if you will. That was that part that she was combating as well because she wanted to maintain her dignity. She didn't want to lower herself. But she could, you know, and
right.
It wasn't that she didn't have the ability or the strength, but the times in which she lived, she was so composed, you know. It was just amazing the strength that I did not realize until later, becoming an adult, that it took in those moments. I didn't realize until I was a parent myself of the sometimes just the ability and the wisdom it is to have restraint.
That suggests, too, the power of music as a language in and of itself.
Yes.
To try to help us understand things that maybe words can't even explain.
Yes, and it took me back, especially now as an adjunct professor at Duke University, as I teach this music. It also tells me more and more about this coded messaging in these songs, how powerful it was, because that was that coded message that my grandmother was not just sending a message to me, but to herself. There was a lot going on in that moan. You know, even in when I'm asking her that question, you know, there was so much in that to have to unpack as a kid. But as I grew older, I began to understand everything that she meant. I understand that there were days in my life that there were no words that could verbalize what I needed to come out of me during an experience. But to moan or to hum or to groan, that was a way of getting that out. It was almost a deliverance, if you will.
I want to talk to you about your grandfather. You said he was not a sharecropper. He had quite a job.
My grandfather farmed. He was a farmer. Lord knows he loved it. He had a John Deere tractor. Owned his own land on Indian Camp Road in Smithfield. He ran liquor for Percy Flowers. And I never understood the dynamics of that. That made no sense to me as I grew older. Because I'm thinking now, Percy Flowers. course, you know, I'm thinking he was a part of the Klan, I'm thinking. And he owned all of, like, 42 Highway, you know. So I'm thinking, you know, how does this happen? How does that work? I'm not sure how that worked. So when I got old enough and the courage enough to ask my grandfather about that, his answer was, I asked him, you know, Granddaddy, you know, you're farming. You know, I thought it was doing quite well. My father, my parents, even when my father told me about how that when they got of age, my father bought them a car, which was like almost unheard of to buy your teenage sons a car for an African-American family. Farming, hog killing time. They were killing hogs. They were doing all of this. And so, you know, I just thought, how does a black man in Smithfield do this, you know? And he was making his hustles. He was farming and hustling. And so when I had the courage to ask him, you know, why were you running liquor for Percy Flowers? And so he just said, he looked at me one day and he just looked at me just, and all he said was, money is green. So I was like, okay, Granddaddy.
There we go. Mary D. Williams, a gospel singer, an adjunct professor at Duke, and much, much more. We'll talk about her on the state of things. First, on the way out here, we'll hear Mary D. Williams sing a song from the film Blood Done Signed My Name. It's called Ain't Gonna Let Nobody, and you'll hear that on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.
Turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, keep on walking.
This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest is gospel singer and educator Mary D. Williams, talking about your grandparents who lived a kind of an independent life in Johnston County. Tell us about growing up in Garner.
Oh, well, Garner was great. It was amazing. My parents had no idea that I could sing until I was like in middle school, which is very unusual. Often when I'm interviewed, people ask, you know, how young were you? You know, you had to start as a little tot. But I actually didn't sing. There was so much music going on in our home, I think. And then my dad was a quartet singer. So I think we were kind of caught up in that. But I was in middle school and my teacher, Miss Emma K. Bird, heard me kind of clowning around in the hallways and said, you need to be in chorus. And so it was that teacher that actually got me started in chorus. And she heard something in me and started really working with me. I got in chorus and she started me on Italian opera. At the time, I was a very sharp, very crisp first soprano. And I had a really high range. So she started teaching me. I don't know anything about music, so I'm not musically trained, but she started teaching me the lyrics, so I just memorized that and was able to memorize the music and the composition, and in so doing, won several competitions and that kind of thing, and so I just realized that was my passion, and it kind of started from there. We were a middle-class family. My dad was self-employed. He owned a landscaping company, and we lived on a road called Jones Sausage Road. And there were a lot of teachers, and my aunt and uncle still live there on that road today, Mr. and Mrs. James Barber. And so I grew up on that road with a lot of love and a lot of community. We had a lot of challenges because of being a middle-class family, the challenges that we encountered, again, because of racial issues. My brother and I riding bicycles, sometimes beer cans being thrown at us, people threatening us as we rode our bicycles, or my dad and I also rode horses. We were in the parades and things in the area. And I can remember people trying to run us off the road with riding horses and stuff like that, because it was just kind of unusual seeing African Americans riding horses and doing those kinds of things.
So you do think it was particularly difficult for you in those days in your family because of the fact that your father was independent. He had his own business and you had some money.
Yeah, I think it was just very different. My dad was a very, he's still a hardworking man to this day still. And my mom, they worked very hard. And I think it was just a challenge. I remember particularly a teacher. teacher taking me home one afternoon. I can't even remember why this teacher took me home, but the teacher specifically said to me, "I want to see where you live. You know, I don't mind. I'm going to give you a ride home." It was the principal. I don't know what the situation was, why the teacher had to take me home, but he was like, he was very specific in that. He said, "I just want to see where you live." You know, and so, but it was almost like unbelievable.
Right.
I do remember a friend, my very dear friend, I'm not going to mention her name on the air, but her father was a part of the Klan, but she and I had become friends in school. Her mom and my mom worked at the Jesse Jones sausage plant together. She and I were very close, but it was so evident. I don't think I realized the impact of racism until that relationship. Because she being Caucasian, I'm African American, and I had invited her to my home, and that was the breaking point. That was where it all had to end. She couldn't come to my home.
Yeah.
That was totally out of the question. My father, then I didn't realize the other side of the racism as far as even on my side of it, as far as my dad, because my dad, you know, he was really, you know, he was like, no, you know, white people can't come here.
Mm-hmm.
And her dad was like, no, you know, black people can't come here. So she and I were in the middle of that. And it really became more evident then.
Well, I mean, the sheer complexity of it that you've described here, having personal relationships that are fine, business relationships, a Klan member and an independent black man with your father working together to run liquor, because as your grandfather pointed out, money is green, and that's a neutral color in this country. And yet publicly, and this is where it really becomes a problem, the face that we have to show our neighbors then becomes the issue.
Yes, because even in those dynamics, my grandfather actually could not address Percy Flowers in daylight on the streets of Smithfield. And then in this situation with this young lady being friends, it was okay in a public school at East Garner. That was fine. But to cross the threshold of our personal dwellings, that drew the line. And her parents were not in the same financial situation as my parents. So that made a big difference as well.
They weren't doing as well.
And so that made a big difference. And so it really kind of ended things in a large sense. And it was kind of disturbing.
You said your father had a landscaping business, and I think you and your siblings all worked for him, right?
My brother. I had a brother that, unfortunately, my brother died 3 years ago very suddenly. But my brother and I worked for my dad in the summer times. We did, my dad did the landscapes in McGregor Downs and carried those landscapes in that area. So did really, really well. Had a lot of encounters, though, because, again, African-American. I remember a lot of insults that he gained because he was self-employed. And I remember specifically one incident where these folks had purchased this home, and but it was, of course, subdivision. So, you know, the houses are being built. And so the gentleman asked my father, "Nigga, I want to know who's your boss." You know, and so my dad was like, "Okay, I am the boss. You know, I own this company." And so I just saw my dad, and my dad has a temper. You know, so
no moaning and low singing.
No, there was no singing there. And so now I remember, you know, my dad, you know, he was like, you know, "That cracker, blah blah blah." That, you know, and I'm like, "Oh my God," you know, and I'm sitting there with my brother, and I'm like, "Okay, what's getting ready to happen?" But it was so ironic because it was just immediately assumed that it wasn't his business, and it was just, you know, and it wasn't anything that wasn't resolved. It got resolved, but I just saw him go through a lot, you know, just fighting to, again, everything that my grandmother said as far as be your own person, standing on your own 2 feet, be that person that's respected, make your name stand for something. I saw before even becoming an adult, hearing my parents trying to do the same thing, and it was being played out in front of me.
And they were pushing for your father in particular for your economic independence, not so much for education, but making sure that you were set up in business. Talk about his aspirations for you and how he saw
future. Dad, he was, you know, they didn't, my parents pushed hard work. I honestly say that we weren't, my father quit school in the, I want to say the eighth, ninth grade. My mother was a high school graduate. So I can honestly I'll tell anyone, my parents really pushed work. They pushed work. So it was my personal aspiration to go to college. I wanted to do that because it was just important to me. But they really pushed work. That was the mantra in the Dobbin family. You know, you work, you don't have to look over your shoulder. You know, you work and you work for the best and you have your own. My father has always been an advocate of being able to work out what you have and take ownership of it and not having to look over your shoulder and worry about somebody taking from you, you know. Yeah. So that's always been his thing. That for me as his daughter and my mom, that I just wanted to go. I wanted to go to school. That was a big thing for me.
What were you thinking of doing?
Well, at the time I was actually thinking about going to school for business administration and that kind of thing. But everything kind of took a turn, and I actually ended up going to school for a while at Fayetteville State and then stopping. And then I ended up at social services for like 30 years.
Well, tell us about that turn, because you talked about music and in high school having a little classical training and opera training and doing mm-hmm. quite well in that. Let's stay with that for a minute and then talk about what happened in college, because, obviously if you're good at opera, right, and you're winning some awards, what made you change, or did you?
Some things happened. I went to Brevard, Brevard University, offered me a scholarship, actually. At that time, there were so many things happening in my family. There were some personal things going on in my family. And I don't know, as when you're growing up, I don't know why we think we can do so much. I don't know. I think a lot of kids think that you can, if you're closer to home. I was thinking, because Brevard, you know, that's up in the mountains. So I'm thinking being closer to home, some things are going on in our personal home. So I'm thinking if I'm closer to home, maybe, I don't know.
You can fix it.
Maybe.
You can fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, no, of course, not. So anyway, so I went to Brevard, offered a full scholarship, and I turned it down. And so I got back home.
That would have been for music, for singing?
Yes. Okay. It was for professional training. So I ended up coming back, going to Fayetteville State, things just kind of went haywire as far as my family, my mom and dad, some things were going on there. And so we ended up, I went to school there for not even a full year, I ended up coming back to Raleigh, got my own place and started working. And then I met my husband, then we got married, and then we started a family. Things just kind of escalated. So then in doing that, I worked at social services and then stayed there for 30 years. I just retired 3 years ago.
Wow.
For 30 years there. But in all of that, opportunities just started coming, even in the music. I never let that go. Even in having children, I often tell my kids, this is what I love and this is what is somewhat of a calling, and I'm sure you can relate to that. This is what I've been called to do, so I know you'll probably get tired of it. So what I'm going to do is we're going to just work together. But I would pack them up, we'd pack up the kids, and everywhere I would have to go sing. My kids were, little. They would go with me. But we had three sons and very athletic. So in between football games, basketball, wrestling, none of them played basketball, football, baseball, wrestling, and different things like that. They were like being in tow to wherever I had to sing.
And so where you go? You're doing concerts?
I was just everywhere. I had opportunities all over because people were, again, similar to what is going on now, it's almost word of mouth. Mm-hmm. Things were happening for me. I was singing at churches all over. I was opening for gospel artists at different locations. So I was just performing.
Well, let's tell us about this music, because you bill yourself as a traditional gospel artist.
Right.
And that suggests that there's something else, and we'd call that contemporary. And, of course, then it branches in all kinds of directions. So what is traditional gospel?
Traditional gospel for me is when we talk we're talking about the spirituals and just branching from that, just a little bit branching from that when we talk about hymns and I'm not even sure if we want to label it as gospel. to a certain extent when we talk about traditional.
Well, let's talk about the spirituals. Let's go back to the root and talk about the difference, if there is one, or the evolution of spirituals to what you would call traditional gospel music.
Okay, so when we're talking about the spirituals, we're talking about those songs of the enslaved. We're talking about those that branched, that came out of that narrative. So sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home. That narrative of that enslaved mother where a child was taken from her and sold on the auction block, or that narrative of the enslaved in that invisible church where they've heard about the story of Daniel in the lion's den. Did my Lord deliver Daniel? And why not every man? Or songs of Moses and Pharaoh. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt land. Tell all Pharaohs to let my people go. Because to that slave, Pharaoh represented that plantation owner. And there was someone that Moses, that was a representation of Moses, that was coming to set the people free. And in that anticipation, in that slave narrative of looking for that Moses with that expectation, and these songs coming out of that experience based on the stories of that they had not read because unable to read, but these stories that they had been told or that they had heard.
So much of this music was composed out of the experience here in North America, but came from West Africa. And I remember the Reverend Dr. Luke Powery, who's Dean of Chapel at Duke, talking about, who's written extensively on the spirituals. And in his book, he talks about those moans being the moans in those slave ships, the Middle Passage, so that it really contains music that goes back before.
That's right.
Arrival.
That's right. It does. And it actually, that acculturation after arriving, then this acculturation of taking what from West Africa and what came from here, you know, and kind of acculturating it, coming together and developing, you know, this music that was birthed, you know, in the bottom of a boat, actually. You know, in the bottom of the boat.
And when you sing that, and again, we talked earlier about coded language and the codes and the various levels of meanings that this would have. Mm-hmm. This is music that has become very popular for all Americans and is considered American music, quintessentially American. And yet it must have very different meanings for various audiences and for singers as well and performers.
I think so. I know for me, one of the things that I have found it to be for me is a way of sharing, you know, I feel like it's my responsibility to share the burden of my ancestors. Is I've taken it on as a responsibility, but I feel it as a responsibility to share with the world this music that has actually been a platform for all genres of music. It has been the foundation of every genre, country music, jazz, blues, it has been that launching pad. And I think for me, I've held on to it even in those years, as we were aforementioned, where as with my family being young and I was performing, I was ridiculed a lot of times. I was singing on platforms like the Bobby Jones Show. I opened for artists, some very contemporary artists, you know, CeCe Winans, different artists such as that. And one of the things that people always ask me, you know, can't you sing something a little bit more contemporary? but it is what is almost, I can say, is just embedded within my bones. It's all within my being. And I wanted to stick with that because that's where it kind of pours out of me. You know, I can do it so simplistically, if you will. And the heart of me, it still touches me. You know, I that's the only way I know to say it. I don't grow tired of it.
Well, neither do we. And in fact, we're going to take a break right now and listen to some of your singing. Mary D. Williams, who is my guest on The State of Things, we'll talk more with her about her experience as a gospel singer and an educator working with Tim Tyson, teaching students in this area about spirituals. But first, Mary D. Williams with the title track from the film Blood Done Sign My Name. We'll be right back. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with educator and singer Mary D. Williams, a gospel singer and an adjunct professor at Duke University, and working closely with Duke professor and writer Tim Tyson, who is the author of Blood Done Sign My Name. It became a movie, and you work with him now on this class. Tell us about meeting Tim. How did you meet Tim Tyson?
Tim and I met. I was a surprise for him. I was invited by a group in Raleigh called the Racial Reconciliation. They, at that time, Tim was not a professor here yet. He was at the University of Wisconsin. Right. He was being invited here to speak and on the book Blood Done Sign My Name, and they called me up and asked me to if I would sing. They said that he loved music before he lectured. So they just asked me to do a performance. So I bought the book and I read it, and interwoven throughout the entire book is just is spirituals. From the beginning, from the title itself, which was recorded by Hudie Leadbelly as a blues, then as kind of bluegrass, and then from there Radio 4 recorded it as a spirit, as a gospel. So the title itself caught my eye. So I read it and I kind of interwove a medley. And he came, we were at the, I think it was Peace College. I think that's where we were. But anyway, we were there. I did the medley, and I get so excited when I sing. I really get excited. I perspire very heavily, and I sweat. And so I was coming down off the stage after singing, and so he embraces me at the bottom of the steps. And so his, you know, and so he, when he hugs me, and I'm like, man, he perspires as heavily as I do, you know. So I'm like, what's going on, you know. So, but there were, these were tears. And so then his wife, she just embraced me. His mother said to me as she embraced me, she said, you've touched us today in ways that we've not been touched before. And it just meant so much. So at the end of that, he wrote his name in my book, and he told me, he said, could you, we need to talk. And that was really the beginning. He had a lecture actually in Oxford like 2 days later. And he was telling me about it. And my son, my middle son, I probably shouldn't say this on the airways, but my middle son hated school at that time. He hated school. So he was the one that really
will not
pushed.
Come as a, that anybody's son hated middle school is not going to come as a shock to anybody, but go ahead.
Why he hated school. So, but Tim was doing the lecture. And so it was my youngest son, Alvin, and Justin. So they were there with me. We were packing things up. And so Tim said, well, I'm going to be at Oxford. Can you come there? And I was like, yeah. So then Justin was like, can we go here? And Mom, can we go? And I'm like, you want to go? Yes, we'll be there. Child, yes, we're going. So that was really the beginning of it. We actually ended up being there that evening. Tim talked to me. He wrote his phone number and everything in my book, and he was like, we really got to talk. And so it really started from there. We started traveling, and that's been 10, 11, that's been 12 years almost.
And in the meantime, the book, of course, the book we should talk about, this Blood Done Signed My Name is a book that's about a true story in Oxford, North Carolina.
Yes.
You're talking about now the murder of a young black man by white people in Oxford, North Carolina. Tim's father, Vernon, was a minister there at the time. And so Tim was living there and then as a young man, then writes this story, which then became a film as well. And let's play a little clip from the trailer of that film.
All that time he was in the service, I prayed that nothing would happen to him. Somebody should have told me I needed to be praying he wouldn't get shot in his own hometown.
We live in difficult times. Grant us the power to choose right from wrong. And the strength to love all people.
You can have whatever you can take, but you can only keep what you can hold.
I'm talking about equality. And they're not going to let you keep it without a fight.
That's a clip from the trailer of the film Blood Done Signed My Name. And that woman you heard singing in the background is Mary D. Williams. She's part of the film and helped make the soundtrack. Tell us about being part of that film and why that was important to you.
Oh, well, I loved it. I've been working with Tim for so long, and the book is an amazing book, and he's an amazing writer. The film, as I aforementioned, I worked for social services for quite a while. But what I did when we found out about the film and everything, I was so fortunate because I was able to go with Jeb Stuart, Tim, Vernon Tyson, Reverend Tyson, when they started the entire process at the very beginning. So when I found out that they were going to do the film and everything had been signed off on, I talked to Jeb and he asked me to be a part of the film. And so at the time, I had no idea what role that I was going to play, but I was just so excited. So then as things continued in the process, I actually went back to and talked with my supervisor and actually took a leave of absence from my job and actually spent the entire time on set during the entire process of the film. So from Shelby to Charlotte, where it was filmed. So I was on set every single day, and it was an amazing experience. My children were in the film. My husband was in the film. It was just a great experience. I got a chance to just get a feel for how that whole process worked. Got a chance to meet Nate Parker and talk with him. Layla Rashad, got a chance to speak with her. And the young man that played Vernon Tyson, I can't think of his name at this point. It escapes me. But anyway, got a chance to spend time with him and Vernon. We were all on set together. So we spent a lot of time every day on set. What was so great about it, though, when we first started the filming segment in Shelby, Jeb Stuart got a letter from the Klan. In Shelby, North Carolina, that's where Birth of a Nation was filmed, which is the first film that was ever filmed. And
not Nate Parker's Birth of a Nation. But
no,
we're
no,
about
the original Birth of a Nation, yeah. Yes. And Jeb got a letter from the Klan asking to meet about Blood Done Signed My Name being filmed in Shelby. And so it was amazing to see all of this stuff coming up during this time over this movie being filmed in Shelby. And it was so ironic because there's a Klan scene there where they had to literally burn the cross. And it was just a tremendous experience. It was so surreal. Jeb did not meet with the Klan, but it was just to be in on how all these things were kind of dealt with in this. What we did do, though, Nate Parker, Tim, and I had community We had a community talk, if you will. And so what we did in Shelby was they put the word out that we were going to do a community event. I got a chance to sing and talk about the music. And then Tim and Nate got a chance to talk about, Tim talking about the book, Nate talking about it from the perspective of an actor and then as an African-American male as well. And then we did it out on the lawn there in Shelby.
Jeb Stuart, by the way, the filmmaker, and there again is another irony in this, in all of this, it being named Jeb Stuart. It was Ricky Schroeder who played Vernon.
That's right.
But so tell us about those meetings, because again, I think, you know, so many people are at a point now where, you know, you hear this from time to time. Look, why are we still having these conversations on race? Enough about race already. But it's not. I mean, if you go to Shelby and you find out that the Klan still resents the fact that you would come here. And tell this story on what they consider their turf.
Their turf.
In 2010.
Right. It was really ironic because I didn't realize that Birth of a Nation had been filmed there until we got there. But the emotions behind, almost like you're not, it's like we're still in control.
Yeah.
And to bring that movie there, but then to have this conversation.
Well, how did that go? How did it go?
The conversation was amazing.
Yeah.
The conversation was amazing because one of the things that that the work that Tim and I do together when we're not in the classroom is these town hall situations or wherever we're invited on universities, wherever, is that he, of course, Caucasian, I African-American, but to have this conversation in a mixed setting, to have an opportunity to just have an open forum about race, to, as he so eloquently puts it all the time, to lean into it, not to get, you know, in anybody's face, but to lean into these expressions or these feelings of white supremacy, to take hold of a situation and to have open conversation about these things that you think we should push aside. Where as an African-American mom with three African-American sons of a darker hue and the things that they continue to experience. My son, Alvin, who owns he has his own company, Bright Light, who, you know, takes cameras and takes photos. You know, I have another son who does Boston, who does teaching children. He has a company, West, that tutors young African-American boys. Mm-hmm. Then my son Justin in the military, who deals with and confronts issues all the time as African-American men who are trying to be productive citizens in their communities.
Right.
Okay, you know, it's hard to let it die when every time they make a move to in doing something very constructive, then we're having a conversation about how they had to, you know, they're confronted with issues.
Yeah. But I wonder who shows up at these things. Do the people who have the biggest issues or the biggest resentment about why you're there show up? I mean, or are these people who are generally think that we should have a conversation and more open-minded?
In this particular case, in Shelby, I think it was because it was a movie being filmed.
Yeah.
We had a really good crowd, but I can't tell you personally that anybody from the Klan showed up.
No, but you might have antagonistic questions. You can tell if people don't like what you're doing.
And we did. We had those kinds of questions, and we always try. One thing I can say about music, and this is why I love doing what I do, one of the things is when we start with the music, one of the things that I find imperative is to get the audience to participate in the music. I'm not singing at them. We are singing together. So when we get the opportunity to sing the songs together, that ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Or if we sing together, oh, freedom over me. Before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. as we sing those songs together, this music is running through us. It's going, not just touching us emotionally, but intellectually. And then we're having this conversation. It somehow, Frank, blankets the room. And what ends up happening is that we have this open conversation, but people leave with a different kind of experience. And it's not just because one thing we don't want people to do, we don't want people to leave with, oh, I'm so sorry this happened. You had nothing to do with it. A lot of times these were our ancestors. So it's not a blame game. It is a situation of what are we going to do now in this, you know, with what we have, and we're going to leave here different. We're going to leave here being willing to have a different kind of conversation, a different kind of relationship.
Well, it seems to me too that we talked about coded language and the way the music speaks beyond the code. It transcends that code. Mm-hmm. When we talk to each other, sometimes we can remain in our silos and use our language and protect ourselves. But if I truly feel your experience through the music and your code penetrates my defenses and also speaks to an experience that I had that's quite similar, I suspect that that's where perhaps some of the coming together happens.
I think so. And it happens all the time. It happens in a public forum. It happens in our classrooms. I can remember the song I sang earlier. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. I can remember singing that song where a student was, you know, I sang the song because of the slave narrative, you know, but her experience was totally different, but the relationship was still the same. This young lady had been through an experience where she had been adopted and never got a chance to know her real mother. And then when she found out about her real mother had passed away. But that soothing balm threw in by that song at that moment was what she needed. She came to me in tears and just kind of just fell, you know, in my embrace. You know, we embraced her, but it was such a moment, but it was a different experience, but yet still that loss. And that song was what she needed. It was that soothing balm, or as Martin Luther King says, that balm in Gilead.
And I'm guessing not just for her in that moment, but also allowed her to feel your experience in a way that she may never have understood before.
Exactly. And we were able, because again, yeah, through that narrative, because that looking up, that gospel impulse, because at the end of that song, A Long Way From Home, it's almost got that gospel impulse of I'm going to see them again. You know, so many of the songs were, you know, I may not, you know, see you now, or when it talked about Canaan land, when it talked about Jordan, we're not, it may not be in the now, but it may be in the future as far as heaven or later on.
Bringing us great hope, and you have done just that. Mary D. Williams, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
And thank you for having me.
Mary D. Williams, a gospel singer and educator. Right now, she's working on a stage performance about Mahalia Jackson, so we will stay tuned for that. Teaches a course called The South. What is the course called?
South in Black and White.
The South in Black and White. And you can find out more about the classes and all of her work at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley's our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Once again, let's listen to Mary D. Williams, the song, How I Got Over.
How I Got Over.